First in this hour on the program, we are very excited to welcome to the show a man who spent 25 years in the major leagues, winning some 283 games. If you don't think baseball has changed, let me give you these numbers from his 1966-67 season. He had 79 starts and 32 complete games just in those 2 years. He went on to become a pitching coach for the Cincinnati Reds and then a long career as a terrific broadcaster with the Twins, the Yankees, CBS, ESPN, the MLB Network. He will be inducted into baseball's Hall of Fame at Cooperstown this summer. And he's the co-author with Douglas Lyons of a wonderful new book, Good as Gold, My 8 Decades in Baseball. Jim Cott joins us this afternoon. Jim, thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Rick.
And congratulations on a long overdue induction to the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Well, I really appreciate that. It's a humbling honor. Quite honestly, I didn't think it would come, but certainly grateful that it did. And it's been an exciting 5 months so far, and seems like it just keeps getting better.
Well, I've been a fan of your work on the air, and of course, as a player, I've got a pretty healthy collection of some classic Jim Cott baseball cards. And one of the things I really enjoyed about the book is the fact that even once you became a player, you never stopped being a fan of the game.
No, I feel that this is my 63rd year in Major League Baseball, and I was so fortunate. My dad took me to my first games. June 26, 1946, that's where I like to say I fell in love with baseball. Saw a doubleheader with the Red Sox and Tigers. Saw Ted Williams, Bobby Doerr, Hank Greenberg, Hal Newhouser, all Hall of Famers, future Hall of Famers. And my dad went to the Hall of Fame in 1947 to see the induction of his favorite player, Lefty Grove. And he used to quiz me, and I knew the answer to this question eventually before he even got the question out. And it was Ty Cobb, Walter Johnson, Christy Mathewson, Babe Ruth, and Honus Wagner. And the question was, who are the first 5 inductees into the Hall of Fame? So I knew that before I was 10. And that's a little background on why I have always been a fan of the game.
I love the story in the book about your favorite player as a kid, Bobby Shantz, and how you not only got to know him, but became good friends with him.
Yeah, Bobby Shantz was 5'6". 135 pounds. He won the American League MVP in 1952. You can Google his stats. You won't believe the year he had pitching, but it was a radio game then. When I would hear the game described over the radio and he was pitching against the White Sox, which is a station I was able to listen to in southwestern Michigan, they would always say, here's Bobby Shantz, best fielding pitcher in baseball, lands on the balls of his feet. He's ready to go left or right. Always ready for a ball hit back at him. And so as a young kid, I mimicked Bobby's motion. In my early years as a professional, the pitching coaches, when we went through pitching drills, pitching fielding drills, used to say, kid, you look just like Bobby Shantz. And then fast forward 3 years ago, I usually present the Gold Glove Awards to the current winners. And Rawlings asked me if I'd ever heard of Bobby Shantz. And I said, heard of him. He's my boyhood idol. So they said, well, we're going to bring him in and have you present him with a legacy award. So at age 80, 3 years ago, I gave an award to Bobby, who 3 years ago was 93. I just heard from him the other day through his friend Steve, who handles most things for Bobby. And he was hoping to come to my induction, but he's just not getting around well enough to do it. But boy, it was some thrill for me to be able to meet him and get to be friends with him.
Oh, it's a wonderful story. And obviously you took great pride in your fielding, more gold gloves than anybody else. What was the key to that?
Well, I think as a kid, you know, the game wasn't as specialized. It's even specialized now going down to the Little League era, you know, Little Leagues. But I was pre-Little League. We just played sandlot ball. And I think we always took pride on being a baseball player. And in my case, just happened to be a pitcher. So we learned to run the bases, slide, handle the bat, bunt, all of those things. And because Bobby was my inspiration, I just found out that you know, being, hey, as long as you're out there, it doesn't take a lot of skill to be a good fielding pitcher. It just takes anticipation and practice, and you can certainly help yourself and save yourself a lot of outs by being able to field your position.
Well, and you're in pretty exclusive company, too, as a guy who also managed to hit 16 home runs and drove in over 100 in your career.
Well, I think that goes back to what I just mentioned. You know, I wanted to be a baseball player that just happened to be a pitcher. I mean, I'm just so impressed by what Ohtani can do out on the West Coast. I mean, that would be a dream of mine, to pitch every 4 days and then be the DH the other three or maybe play first base one day. So, you know, I always I had the athletic ability to do it, but I always was able to work on my hitting. And, of course, today I can understand why they want the DH, because the pitchers today, they didn't even bat in Little League a lot. They always had a DH in Little League.
Right.
So I really can't expect them to go up there and hit. And that's why they needed a DH. In my era, I was kind of disappointed to see it come in 1973, because I enjoyed the hitting part of it.
We're talking with Jim Cott here on Downtown. I want to talk about your early career. You came up with the old Washington Senators, then made the transition when they moved to Minnesota as part of the expansion. Is it safe to say that owner Calvin Griffith had a very old school approach to negotiations?
Yeah, he certainly did. Well, we were the Washington Senators until the fall of 1960. I was in the Instructional League, which is a developmental league for young players. And we came to the park one day down in St. Pete, Florida, and they said, well, you're now the Minnesota Twins. So we were pretty excited about it, because we knew the positive move it was for the Milwaukee Braves when they moved from Boston. But, yeah, playing for Calvin, you know, those were the days when owners made their living owning a baseball team. And nowadays, of course, it's conglomerates and wealthy hedge fund operators, so owning a baseball club is just one of many things they do. It's a hobby for many of them. So, but in Calvin's case, he employed 19 members of his family, so it was his livelihood. And before free agency, we had no leverage, no bargaining power. So it took a lot of stubbornness and arguing to get an extra few dollars out of Calvin.
1965, your Twins team put it all together. A great year from Zoilo Versailles, the MVP that year, Tony Oliva, Harmon Killebrew. What a wonderful team it was. And then you get to the World Series, three starts, all of them up against Sandy Koufax.
Yeah, that was a thrill, and yet it was kind of a helpless feeling. You know, in those days, the only game on television was Saturday afternoon baseball game of the week with Dizzy Dean and Pee Wee Reese. And we were playing on Saturday like every other team was, so I really never saw Sandy pitch in person. Never met him in person till we posed for photographs before the games we started. So I'm out in the bullpen warming up, and he's about 20 feet away, and I thought, wow, I've never seen anything like that. I should say I've never heard anything like that with his with his fastball. And we started the game, and we each went through the batting order pretty easily the first time. I mean, they didn't have as powerful a hitting team as we did, which is why I respect Sandy even more, because he had to win so many close games. But I mentioned to my pitching coach, Johnny Sane, after the third inning, I said, John, if I give up a run, this game's over. I don't think anybody could score off this guy. And of course, we scored two runs, one unearned, and we ended up winning that game 5-1, and I was right. We only scored one earned run off him in six innings that game, and the other two complete game shutouts.
2 years later, one of the great pennant races in Major League history. As a young Red Sox fan back then, I remember it so well, with the Twins, the Red Sox, the White Sox, and the Tigers all going right down to the final weekend. You started in that next to last game against Boston. You just needed a win, and the Twins would clinch, and then you got hurt. And I think a lot of Red Sox fans would say, if Jim Cott doesn't get hurt on that Saturday game, it might have been a very different outcome to that season.
Well, it's always been kind to hear that from Red Sox fans and from people like yourself. I know Yaz and Hawk Harrelson mentioned too many times that they thought it might be the case. It was really the best month of pitching I ever had. I actually had pitched the equivalent of seven complete games in that month. One was a 10-inning game. One was pitched 8 innings. But I think that and pitching 300 innings the year before, we didn't monitor those things then, but I probably was getting near the end of putting that kind of stress on my arm. And so I tore that tendon that's now popular for Tommy John surgery, and I had to come out of that game. But, and looking at the Red Sox and the way they turn things around, I don't think any player that I've been around baseball has ever had a September like Carl Yastrzemski did in 1967. And he hit the big three-run homer in that game that I started, and it just seemed like every time he came up with men on, he's going to knock in a run. And, of course, maybe what gets overlooked is how well he played the wall in left field also. So, yeah, I take a little satisfaction amongst my Red Sox friends that I live near in Vermont as saying, well, I kind of helped produce Red Sox Nation.
Well, and for anybody who says pitchers shouldn't hit, I vividly remember Jim Lomborg's bunt single in that last game of the season that started the rally.
Oh, no question. And, Lonnie and I are still friends. I was there to present him with an award at the Tradition a few years ago up there in Boston, but we became teammates and lockered next to one another in Philadelphia in 76, 77, right during that era. But, yeah, the year he had as well, and you're right, that little bunt single that kind of started the rally and enabled him to come back and beat us in that last game. And then, once they beat us, I had a friend on that team named Lee Stang. He was a former teammate. And so I went over to the Red Sox clubhouse to congratulate him and to see Yaz. I'd played against Yaz, of course, for several years. And they were still listening to the radio for the Detroit game because they had to wait to see if the Tigers won.
Right.
The Tigers would be coming in for a one-game playoff. So they had to wait. And Dick McAuliffe, who was a New Englander, a Connecticut native, hit into a line drive to end a double play to end that second game, and then the Red Sox could start celebrating. So even though we didn't win it, it was just a fabulous experience during that month of September when every game we played seemed like it was the last game of the World Series.
Jim, you wrote in your book that your favorite managers in your long career were Chuck Tanner and Whitey Herzog, essentially because they respected you as players and just left you alone to do your thing.
Well, I think where Chuck came into the equation is when I was picked up by the White Sox off the waiver list, I finished okay in 73, and in 74, I couldn't get anybody out. I lost five games in a row. Harry Carey's on the air, and he's calling for him to get rid of me and bring a couple young starters in. And so we came off a road trip getting my luggage at O'Hare Airport in Chicago, and Chuck said, come in a little early tomorrow. I want to talk to you. And I thought, well, I can see what that's going to be about. He's got a couple young starters, Skip Pitlock and Carl Moran down in the bullpen, and he's probably going to tell me, well, you had a nice 15 career, and maybe it's time to look for something else to do. But I walked into Chuck's office, and he slapped me on the back. And Chuck is the most positive most positive person I've ever been around. And he said, look, you've been averaging 15 wins a year in this league for 15 years. I think you can still do it. He said, you're going to start a week from Monday. You go down to the bullpen with Johnny Sain, see if you guys can figure something out. So Johnny worked with me on kind of speeding up my motion, and so I get the start. Well, my record when I had that meeting with Chuck was 4-6, and I ended the season 21-13. And without Chuck Tanner's support and Johnny's innovative coaching, my career may have ended by that. So Chuck was important to me because the way he supported me and his faith in his veteran players. I mentioned Whitey Herzog as no manager I played for was a better game manager in terms of matching up the bullpen, getting the best of the other manager. And when that game started, Whitey was like in his own little cocoon. I mean, he was so far ahead of things. One day, I was a seventh inning lefty reliever then, seventh and eighth. And once in a while, I got to pitch the ninth. But one day he said to me, go down to the bullpen a little early today because our starting pitcher, Had not had a lot of success against the team we were playing. He said, I may have to make a move early. And sure enough, I came into that game in the sixth inning. So those are the ways that Whitey was able to manage the game more so than any other manager I played for.
Now, when you became a pitching coach for Pete Rose in Cincinnati, you certainly followed what you had learned from Johnny Sain, and it was a different approach to pitching. You eschewed the pitch count. You looked at things like innings and situations, and you love that four-man rotation.
That's a good point, Rick. You've done your homework. You know, when Pete called me, because when we played against one another, Pete had a way of when he made a ground out, he liked to run over the mound and intimidate the pitcher and cause him to move. And I'd see him out of the corner of my eye, and I would move in his way. And he would run around me, and he'd turn around and kind of look at me with a little grin on his face. And so one day their batting practice pitcher came over to me, and he said, Pete told me to tell you if he gets a managing job, I want you to be his pitching coach. So sure enough, in 1984, he got the playing manager job for the Reds, and called me, and before I took the job, I said, now, Pete, I've got a lot of different ideas on pitching. I said, I had two great pitching coaches that helped me, Eddie Lopat and Johnny Sain. He said, look, I'm thinking about pitching. I know hitting. You come in, and you do whatever you want with the pitching. So I immediately, you know, told the guys I'd like to go to a four-man rotation, which we did. Tommy Browning won 20 games that year, first 20-game winner for a rookie in 31 years, I believe, back to 1954 when Bob Grimm won 20 for the Yankees. And then I was so glad to see today in an interview that Max Scherzer did with Bill Levinson on the MLB.com page. So they asked Max, you know, what's the most important thing to you in pitching? And he said, first pitch strikes. Mm. Well, when I took over as pitching coach, I showed the guys, I said, look, if you get strike one on every hitter, you're going to get 80% of them out. So we didn't have pitch counts. We didn't care. The only thing we wanted is get ahead in the count. Strike one's very important. If you get strike one, get strike two. And that really paid off for us. We had a nice pitching staff that year. So I enjoyed taking what I had learned from those two guys and letting Pete allow me to use it, which, of course, today you'd have no chance to try to use that kind of logic.
We're talking with Jim Cott here on Downtown. Well, Jim, you've had a terrific career as well as a broadcaster, and I was fascinated to learn in the book the advice that you got from John Madden about having notes.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. You know, I did some games early on. The way I got into broadcasting way back when in the 60s, you know, we had to work in the offseason as players. We didn't have huge contracts, and so one winter I did high school sports. I did high school basketball, football, and I'd taken speech classes. And so I always felt comfortable talking sports with people or talking in front of people. So now I get a chance during the 81 player strike to do some games with Ralph Kiner. And then it kind of forwards into, you know, future jobs. And I worked some network games on NBC with Dick Enberg. And Dick was so helpful to me. You know, he was the prototype play-by-play man, very economical with words, but he taught me a lot of the mechanics of broadcasting. And then as I got more experience into it, I had to do a game one night in Minnesota. I was doing CBS games on Saturday afternoons, and the over-the-air station WCCO wanted me to do everything I could to not miss one of their games. So I caught a flight at O'Hare, flew into Minneapolis, got to the Metrodome as they were finishing the national anthem. So all I had was my lineup card. And so all I really had to do, I knew the players, was just watch the game. So I called my broadcast partner, Dick Stockton, the next day. He was my CBS partner. I said, Dick, I did a game last night, and I felt more comfortable doing that game. Like, I was on top of everything. I had no notes. I'm just watching the game. He said, well, that's what John Madden does. I said, really? I'd like to talk to him. So Dick, having worked football with John, hooked me up, and John and I had several conversations that helped me about, you know, you do your homework ahead of time. Of course, he had a whole week because he's only doing one game a week, but you do your homework. You know, you learn the players. You don't want to make any mistakes about, you know, in his case, he said, I didn't want to make a mistake that from this wide receiver, a tough guy, when his teammates knew he might be a little soft or something. So I just learned a lot from John, and I will keep an occasional, you know, note that I think is important. But I found, as he said, if you have a lot of notes, you're going to try to figure out a way to force them in. And a lot of times they don't make sense.
Right.
And if you don't remember, if you don't write anything and there's things that you wish you would have said but you don't remember, they probably weren't that important anyway. So that was good advice for me.
And you've worked with some of the biggest names in the business, but it feels from your book like the dream booth for you was that chance you had for several years on the Yes Network, working with Kenny Singleton, having two former players who could both do play-by-play.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I had worked a couple years with a really fine announcer, Dave Cohen, and Dave wasn't a baseball guy. He was just a great voice and loved the game. And then MSG decided to go a different direction, so they said to me, who do you think you'd like to work with? And I said, well, I'd like to work with the ideal would be another player who's had play-by-play experience, because I said, it doesn't take a lot of skill to do play-by-play on TV. It's the radio guys, like, you know, Joe Castiglione. That's a skillful job to be able to describe that to people that can't see what's going on. And on TV, they can. Well, they tried out several announcers that they brought in with me that were all good, and then they said, well, who's the guy you think? And I said, you know, I know Kenny a little bit, but just the two innings we kind of did today as an audition, I said, I really like the way we got on. So they signed Kenny, and we had, I still get comments. I was at a memorabilia show last weekend up in New York, and they said, man, we just enjoyed those days with Kenny and myself, because we're just two former players talking baseball. You know, as far as a play-by-play guy that really is interested in the game and knows the game, I you know, I've enjoyed my time now in the last almost 14 years doing MLB games with Bob Costas, because, you know, we become friends as well as broadcast partners, and we carry that friendship into the booth.
You were one of the few who spoke up early on and said that this StatCast thing was not going to be good for the game of baseball. And my goodness, were you right on that?
Well, you know, we had a seminar years ago. Everybody was excited. They said, we're going to have this new thing called StatCast, and they're going to measure exit velocity and launch angle. And I attended the seminar, and everybody was so excited about it and what a great new feature it's going to be for the game. And as I flew home that day, I said, you know, it's going to be a revenue producer, but in my opinion, it's not good for the game. And we've seen what it's done to affect hitters in terms of strikeouts and, you know, the game, the way it was meant to be played, with the ball in play and hit and run and squeeze plays and triples. That's all out the window. And all everybody wants to talk about now is exit velocity and launch angle. And, you know, I know three guys that were outstanding hitters and batting champions whose exit velocity wouldn't be in the top 100, and that's Tony Gwynn, Rod Carew, and Wade Boggs. You know, they did pretty well. I just kind of poking them all around. So I don't like the effect that it's had on the game, but yet I understand it. You know, everything in my early era as a broadcaster, it was an analyst game. The executive producers would say, follow the analyst. What's he got to say? What are they looking for? Who's in the bullpen? What's the situation? Well, now, you really don't have as much chance to analyze the game, because you have sales elements and promotional elements that are much more important from a business standpoint. So as much as I love the game, and I still like to watch the ability of the players, you know, the game as a whole is certainly not as appealing, and even my grandsons don't find it as appealing as they did when they were, you know, little leaguers.
If anybody asked you from the commissioner's office, what's the first thing you would do to make the game more appealing to young fans?
Well, I've said this, it'll never happen as fantasy, but I think, you know, after 2.5 hours, a lot of people are ready to go home. So 7 innings is the 9, or 9 is the new 7, whatever you want to put it. But 7 innings, if you can play 7 innings in 2.5 hours, and if you could soften or deaden the ball. Now, I understand there was an article came out today, I just heard, I believe it was on Yahoo Sports, that the pitchers feel they're using two different kinds of baseballs.
Yeah,
that has raised seams, the cover's a little more porous, and it doesn't carry as far. You have one that's slicker with lower seams, and of course, that's the one that would jump. So I'd like to see him soften the ball, and I think the time might be coming to play the game the way we used to play inter-squad games in spring training. Three balls you walk, two strikes you're out. So everybody's up in arms. Why'd Clayton Kershaw come out after six perfect innings? Well, because they're counting pitches, and he had a short spring, and he's coming off maybe an injury from last year. So if you had three balls, you walk, two strikes, you're out, it accomplished two things. They wouldn't have to throw as many pitches in a game like Clayton pitched. And I think, you know, it would motivate hitters to try to put the ball in play sooner. It would motivate pitchers to the ball in the strike zone sooner. I mean, the number of 3-2 counts we have is unbelievable. I will say the one change that they made in the minor leagues that I understand is doing really well, they have about a 14-second pitch clock
right,
with nobody on base. I think they go to 18 with a man on base.
I think so, yeah.
I understand they've shaved about 20 minutes off a game, and that's what I'd like to see them do in the big leagues. I think it'll never happen for a revenue standpoint unless they can say, well, if we can go to our advertisers and get more money, because we're only going to play seven innings and the players will take a 20% pay cut, so that's fantasy right there. But to me, that would make it a more appealing game.
Jim Kott's new book is called Good as Gold, My 8 Decades in Baseball. Jim, it's been wonderful talking baseball with you. Congratulations again on the Hall of Fame induction, and thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
The great Jim Kott with us here on